This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. There's more on power987.co.za.
I'm Dumisang Zovu. Thank you for listening to this Power Update podcast.
We begin our content swiftly this Monday afternoon, looking at the continued issue of state-owned entities seeking more funds to stay afloat. This as it's emerged that government is reportedly considering a 3.2 billion rand guarantee for the cash-strapped SABC. The national broadcaster's financial situation adds to the burden that is Eskom and SAA. Now, these matters are expected to come up in the 6th administration State of the Nation address to be delivered by President Cyril Ramaphosa in Parliament this Thursday. Commentator and accountant Kaya Stolle speaks to us about this. Thank you so much for your time, Kaya.
Good afternoon and good afternoon to the listeners.
The SABC is seeking more funds. Talk to us about the continued danger this poses for the state, especially as rating agencies have already warned against the financial burden of bailing out struggling SOEs, including the likes of SAA and Eskom.
The problem with the state of perpetual bailouts is really the fact that the source of funding is fast drying up. And of course, if as a country we do not raise enough revenue to cover all our expenses, it means we have to go and borrow, and borrowing comes at an even greater cost. So what you're really doing is that you're deferring the decisions that are supposed to be made today on really what is the ideal cost structure and the revenue structure for the SABC, for SAA and Eskom. By not dealing with those issues right now, you're simply deferring the consequences, because all we can do is simply borrow. And when we borrow now, it will be the generations of the future that actually have to pay the price of whatever it is that we're borrowing today. So that really is the big South African conundrum. And for as long as we have the politicians that don't have the courage to do the right thing and to take the unpopular decisions, it's only going to get worse.
And it's those unpopular decisions that I want us to talk about, especially as we ask what then is expected from the president in this regard during the first 6th administration State of the Nation address this coming Thursday. We've seen him make statements about alluding to somewhat of a privatization of some of these SOEs, including Eskom. And when that announcement was made, backlash, of course, came straight after from most sides in terms of union structures, those who are against the privatization or part privatization of state-owned entities. What's to be said about these unpopular decisions that should be in place but actually are not, given the dynamics in South Africa?
The big problem that we have with the people that always push back, it's people who actually do not have to live with the consequences of whatever decision gets taken. So if you talk about the unions, their duty is to defend the status of the incumbents, whether it's the employees within the system or the union members. The problem comes in when somebody walks in to Eskom or SAA and says, look, if I'm going to make this thing financially sustainable, these are the decisions I'm going to take, and some of those decisions will obviously have an impact on headcount. As soon as the conversation becomes that, then the politicians actually just shut down altogether, and they simply say, well, we need the unions in order to win an electoral mandate, so therefore we will not do anything that sort of upsets the unions. The problem with that is that it really exhibits a lack of courage on the part of the political principle. So the key problem here that we're going to have to confront is when the State of the Nation address is delivered, how will the president manage not to talk about something so crucial? And if he does talk about it, how does he frame it in a way that doesn't create an anxiety, in particular in relation to the unions? Now, of course, if he does find a way to put it in a way that leaves the unions thinking that things are not going to be particularly disruptive, it will simply mean that he has lied to us. There is no other way of getting things to be done correctly unless you break the stranglehold that the unions in particular have over decision-making within these particularly important state enterprises. The key issue here is that privatization is not actually the first step. The first step that one always has to interrogate is, could these things in their current form actually be run sustainably if they were run as businesses? And the answer is no, for as long as the ANC believes that people who get elevated into political office become business gurus overnight, who then should have the capacity and the right to meddle in the affairs of a business enterprise, then the problem would carry on. So for me, the big issue is that you start with the thing that is actually the source of the problem, And that is really this conflation between political office and the business of state-owned enterprises.
Yeah.
Very few people within the ANC, and I doubt anyone in government, actually has the business acumen to run an entity as complicated and as complex as Eskom, for example. So why do we still let them have such an important say or an important influence into how these businesses are managed? That is a big problem, long before we get to privatization.
Interesting that you say that, because in President Cyril Ramaphosa, there's always been this renewed hope that one who comes from the business sector may be coming into public office to run it somewhat like a business, similar to what we saw with the tenure of former President Thabo Mbeki and with a finance minister who's as outspoken and very guarded when it comes to policy and structures that are meant to be followed, and not swayed much by union structures, being finance minister Tito Mboweni. One would have expected a different tone from the sixth administration, even so early. Can it still be expected that this can be a resounding voice post the State of the Nation address this week?
No, there are a couple of issues there, of course. And the first one is that we have to be brutally honest and say that Cyril Ramaphosa is not actually a businessman. He's not a person who's got a track record in taking one business from the grassroots and growing it organically to be a multi-billion rand enterprise. He was never such a thing. He was simply the person who was in a fortunate position to capitalize on the wave of BE deals and corporate governance structures that emerged after the 1994 consensus. So we shouldn't conflate his actual world into him being a businessman. He is no such thing. He's primarily a politician. He's primarily a union leader. And in politics, that's where he finds his natural home. But what has become quite important is that, having had access into how things are run more efficiently and more profitably in the private sector, the question was, would he then translate the learnings that he's learned from being involved in businesses one or another to then say, this is how I want the state to be run? Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, for a person who doesn't have a universally overwhelming mandate within his own political party, it's difficult for him to flip the script overnight. And his inability to flip the script overnight means that he spends way too much time, way too much resources simply trying to explain his views and his desires into the political parties and the political partners that he has. And in most instances, he won't always get his way. So that is the fundamental limitation that he has.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in having a finance minister who's outspoken, again, it's wonderful to have a finance minister who can at least be brutally honest with society. But remember, the finance ministry position is not something you and I can go tomorrow and apply for. It is not something that is based on the meritocracy or our ability to run a finance ministry. It is still a political position. So, of course, if his political handlers, being his political party, have a particularly different viewpoint, it is completely irrelevant what the finance minister of the day is thinking. And we're seeing exhibits of that every single day. So the best the finance minister can do is intervene within his own sphere of influence. We saw reports this weekend that is even downgraded the type of car that the state buys for him. Again, wonderful for him. He influences his immediate circle, but is not about to change the ANC overnight into something more responsive to really the prevailing circumstances of the day.
Now, it's a double-edged sword in South Africa, where the worst-case scenario, if the state doesn't continue bailing these parastatals out, the same as if we were to start with reform now, it's not going to give or yield immediate and effective results as soon as the blink of an eye. What's to be said about taking the pain in now, or in some cases, some will argue that this pain should have been taken far more years than the situation that we find ourselves in. But at the same time, when you weigh that against the worst case scenario of an SABC, SAA, as well as Eskom falling apart, we face a very dim and grim picture in South Africa.
The important distinction that needs to be drawn here is really between the concept of the explicit and immediate pain versus the long-term structural pain that we all tend to feel. So if, for example, somebody says that we need to retrench 10 or 15 workers tomorrow, then of course those 10 or 15 workers are going to feel the immediate and the explicit pain of being retrenched. And of course, if I am a union leader, I can easily then say these are the 10 or 15 people that are suffering the consequence of the decision that's being made today. And it's always much easier to actually talk about those because you can see the direct impact. The problem, of course, is that if you don't retrench those 10 or 15 people, in the long run, it won't just be the 10 or the 15 people that actually are without a job. It will be in the entire corporation, because in the long run, if the entity is no longer financially viable, the common sense will prevail that you have to actually shut it down. So it's always this problem that we have, where if I'm talking about immediate decisions that need to be taken, everyone can show me what the immediate pain and the immediate impact is. And of course, we being human beings are going to say, well, let's find a way to defer the retrenchment of those 15 people. But the reason we ended up with the number 15 in the first place is because we've gone back, we've done the numbers, we've looked at the projections, we've looked at the future prospects of sustainability, and we worked out that this thing cannot be sustainable unless you retrench the 15 people immediately. We saw an example of that when the SABC wanted to issue Section 189 notices last year, because they didn't wake up and they say, we just feel like we don't want 10 or 15,000 people. They worked out that it was no longer sustainable to have those many people in the payroll. Now, of course, the politicians prevail and simply say, well, you're going to keep those people in the payroll. And guess what? Now they can't even pay salaries for everyone. So now it's not an issue about the 10 or 15 people that they wanted to retrench at that point in time. It now has a universal impact on absolutely every single person. You saw the same example at SAA when the former CEO of Wiani said, we're at a risk of not even being able to pay salaries. Now, that risk of not paying salaries is not a risk of not paying salaries to the people that you said should be retrenched, and the politicians said no. It becomes a risk of not being able to pay salaries to the entire workforce. So this problem that we have of people just looking at the short and immediate question and the immediate consequences and saying, if these are to be painful, then let's not make the decision altogether, we're only simply deferring the situation to a much wider audience later on.
Sure, it is a tough one to tackle, but what does need to happen for government to assist these SOEs to expand their pool for seeking funding? Because most investors are wary of getting into this playground, particularly on the two sides of government being suspected of partly trying to privatize, and the alarming issue of their fiscal balance. It's not looking great for either of these SOEs.
Well, I suppose the starting point is, should we even have things called state-owned enterprises? And when we talk about state-owned enterprises, what form of ownership is desirable for the state? Now, there is this problem where the state assumes that by simply saying that they're the owners of these enterprises, then that gives them the license to interfere in the operations of it. It is very common for people to actually say, I'm going to be a passive investor into that particular business. Mm-hmm. I have absolutely no idea what it does, but I know what it is that it can turn in the form of profitability, so therefore I put my money there. So we always have this idea of passive investors, people who get business given a business case, and they get asked the question, would you like to invest in this company? And if you do want to invest in it, you put your money on day one, we'll come back to you at the end of the year with the return. So that's really what government ought to do. Unfortunately, here we have this problem of our politicians who suffer from this celebrity fixation, who want to actually be visible in the running of things that they quite simply have absolutely no idea how to run. So if you actually took away their political office from them and you said, please go and run this enterprise, they just wouldn't even make it to even the long list for the interview list. The problem, of course, is that these people now wield enormous power over really how these critical institutions are to be run. And in that wielding of enormous power, they then paralyze these institutions from within. So there's a lot of things that these people who run the institutions, the executives, wish they could do. But because it is such a politically ring-fenced process, the decision-making itself is lethargic. The decision-making itself is very, very compromised by the multiple structures of accountability. So clearly that is not how any business can be run. So I think one has to always go back to the question of what is the difference between a government department and a state-owned enterprise.
Yeah.
And a government department is a structure where everybody acknowledges that there's no prospect of a return here. We're not looking for a return. We're simply trying to provide a service to as many people as possible. Now, everybody's comfortable with that. No one ever complains about the fact that you've made a greater allocation to the health or the education budget, because the understanding is that we're not trying to extract an immediate or a capital return out of that in the first place. If you're then going to put these things on the other side and call them state-owned enterprises, well, the first thing that you must do is run them as enterprises. Right. And if you don't want to run them as enterprises, then convert them into departments. I can guarantee you now, no one has ever complained about an increase in the allocation of any government department, because we all acknowledge that they're cost centers. But if these things are going to be called enterprises, the first thing you must do is learn how to run them as enterprises. And unfortunately, the politicians that we have could not run a spaza shop, so have absolutely no license. They've got no moral authority to run anything referred to as an enterprise.
Cheeky Kaya, but there's also the leadership challenges at these institutions. What's to be said about the state's role in ensuring that the right people are appointed to turn the parastatals around? Mr. Chakana, the outgoing CEO at SAA, mentioned this issue of interference of government not supporting the boards of these parastatals that leads to the paralyzed state that they find themselves in. It's also emerged in the State Capture Commission of Inquiry from a former employee at SAA, who's been giving evidence last week, indicating that there was definitely political interference there.
Well, that is the problem. So when you say that, you know, there wasn't enough support, for me, that's a double-edged sword, because Johanna said there wasn't enough political support. And my argument will be there shouldn't be any political support in the first place, because here, what happens is that when you're looking for political support in a time of crisis, you will not be able to then keep those people out of the boardroom, even in instances when you no longer need them. So you need to be very clear upfront that their role as a state is to provide the initial capitalization of these entities. So think about it. No one in their right mind could have ever started something like Eskom simply because no one in the private sector could ever come up with a financial model that made it possible. So no one can start these things. That's why the state has to step in and actually form the seed capitalization of it. Telkom was a similar example. No one had the capacity to do so in the private sector. So that's why the state has to step in on day one. But thereafter, you must then take a step back and say, if this thing is going to be conceptualized as an enterprise, it should be given the freedom to be run as an enterprise. So I do think here that the risk that you take by saying that I didn't get political support, so therefore I'm getting out, the answer is that had you been given that political support, you would have used it when you needed it, when you're in a time of crisis, but then when you then wanted to do things that are important, things that are necessary for you to run the business properly, then you wouldn't be able to get those people out of your boardroom. So therefore, is that a desirable situation? The answer, of course, is that you need to actually find a way. And Khalima Motlanthe and I have actually proposed this before. We even put a document that is sitting in the presidency, which is to say you must actually start insulating the people that get appointed to these enterprises. Their appointment processes should be depoliticized. Now, what we have currently is that you've got a minister who literally goes through his black book once in a while and decides who's going to be the board of directors of a state-owned enterprise. And this, again, is not based on the fact that these people have got wonderful track records and everywhere else. It's simply a conflation of do they have some business skills and do they have that political proximity to whoever the minister of the day is. So the board itself is also a process that is compromised. And what the board does is that it remembers that it owes its loyalty firstly to the minister that puts it in the boardroom and then to the executives and to the structures that it actually supposed to service. So that particular focus has been completely wrong. All the boards feel that they owe the people that appointed them a favor to do particular things. And once you get away from that mold, where you simply say that anyone who's appointed to head or run a state-owned enterprise will be appointed by an independent, transparent process, like the Public Service Commission, for example, then that would be a good start. But I'm really, really skeptical of living in a country where, for example, the finance minister of the day can be a person like Davis van Rooyen, who then, as some people want now, would be the single shareholder of the Reserve Bank and make very critical decisions and have no one to challenge him because, well, if you're the only shareholder, then your voice is the last one to be heard. So I'm very skeptical of living in a country where we keep elevating people whose competence is remarkably questionable and then giving them this enormous power to actually make decisions about entities whose financial situation actually becomes our universal problem. There's not a single minister who's ever been asked to sign a paycheck to say, well, here's a company that has made a loss. You messed it up by doing this and this, so therefore you must pay for it. It's always a matter of every single South African out there is then asked. And no, when I say it's asked, I'm actually misrepresenting.
Instructed.
Forced, because no one actually asked for our permission.
Yeah.
They simply just take our money. They're about to do it at the SABC next week to pay the salaries. There's absolutely nothing you can do to stop them.
What happens to the mounting calls of reform, Kaya? Are you hopeful, briefly as a parting shot, in that at some point there will be sanity that prevails?
I spend way too much time with politicians, so the answer is absolutely no reforms will take place. Sanity will not prevail. There are far too many vested interests, unfortunately.
Sisenkingeni Budwam, thank you for your input. Commentator and accountant Kaya Stole speaking to us about the continued issues around the funding of state-owned entities. Of course, this comes as it's emerged that the state is mulling over another bailout for the South African Broadcasting Corporation. Whether this will be granted, we are yet to find out from the State of the Nation address to be delivered by President Cyril Ramaphosa for the 6th administration when that event takes place on Thursday evening in the National Assembly.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.